Good morning, everybody. This is Dave Rabbit at www.daverabbit.podomatic.com. As most of you know, I did kind of a preliminary announcement that I was going to be doing an interview with my old friend David Zeiger of Sir No Sir fame. And he's with me today, and we're going to talk to him in just a second. But I wanted to tell everybody they need to go right now, if they can, to www.sirnosir.com, which is David's website, and go down to the storefront. There's a little click-on thing for the storefront, and see some of the incredible things that David has made available on a limited edition basis from the storefront, one of which is the, of course, the DVD of Sir No Sir. It includes the film, the theatrical trailer, the Not Your Soldier, and Ruckus Productions flash animation of the Punk-Ass Crusade, which if you haven't seen it, either through my website over at Above Top Secret or Podomatic, it is absolutely unbelievable. An unbelievable presentation if you haven't seen it. So he's included that. It's $19.95, a fabulous buy for a limited edition DVD of Sir No Sir. And the second thing that he has, and if you buy several things together, the website offers an extremely attractive special price, but the soundtrack, I think, is just unbelievable. I picked up a copy when I went and did my California trip and saw David. It includes the score written by Buddy Judge and performed by the Creepers, the song Soldier Boy by the Shirelles. And the thing that's really most anticipated by me and was just absolutely gorgeous, if you remember in the movie DVD, there is a performance by Rita Martinson, and she's singing to GI resistors that came to this FTA concert. And as she sings the song, Soldier, We Love You, you can see soldiers' eyes tear up as they are listening to Rita Martinson singing to them, making them feel like they're really important. This is just absolutely unbelievable and has not ever been available just since it was originally done back in the 60s. And it's the only copy of it available on CD. So this alone is just an outstanding purchase, and that's the Sir No Sir soundtrack. And then finally, and I've got one of these up on my wall, is the official Sir No Sir poster, which is it was designed by Chris Kirk, and it evokes the mood of the Vietnam era, and it plants its feet firmly in the 21st century because of what we have going on in Iraq. And as everybody knows, I went to California just recently, and the main emphasis was to meet my friend for the first time. Although we have been friends since February 2006, we physically never met, and we went and visited with David Zeiger and had a great time with him and his family, did some special things that may be released down the way, a long way down the way, and just had a really great time. And in the course of our trip there, David and I discussed the possibility of me doing an interview with him. And David's done literally hundreds of interviews worldwide. The movie itself has just been a phenomenal success. And David has become a household word when it comes to documentary filmmaking. And let's just get right into it. Good morning, David. How are you? I'm not doing bad for a kid. I bet the traffic sucks on Labor Day out there in California.
it's typical. It takes about half hour to get down the block, but that's actually pretty light nowadays.
Well, when we were there visiting you and your beautiful family, my son Jack Rabbit wanted to go out to West Coast Customs, and when we left Santa Monica, it was like 3.5 hours. I can't even imagine how long it would take to go today with Labor Day traffic.
Well, you get a good idea about traffic in LA simply by the fact that they have these carpool lanes in the freeways, and you only have to have two people in your car to qualify as a carpool. So every car out on there has got one person in it, and it's pretty crazy.
It is nuts. Okay, listen, when I first told people that I was going to do an interview with you, and you've done hundreds of interviews, as I said previously, There's several things, and of course some of them are recent, so you would not have had an opportunity to address them or talk about them. But I had just several hundred emails about things that people wanted to know. But first off, before we even begin this, you are of the Jewish faith, am I correct?
I was born and raised Jewish, yes.
Okay. But whether you're participating or not now doesn't matter, but still
it's a big part of my cultural background.
Okay, exactly. So I want to establish that because everybody simply just assumes and I want to clarify that. So, okay, let's take you as David Zeiger, the executive producer, director of Sir No Sir, with a background that you have of anti-war and a background that you have of making your opinion known. And these are some of the things, David, that were emailed to me. And just, I'd just like you to just give your own opinion as David Zeiger, not representing the Jewish community as a whole, but just because of your insightful background that you have, what you thought about the situation. And the first at the top of the list is Mel Gibson's comment. And, he did The Passion of the Christ, and as you well know, the Jewish community just went absolutely berserko, as rightly they should, because Mel Gibson really painted out Passion of the Christ that the Jewish people were responsible for the death of Jesus Christ. Now, that said, and because he has that kind of background, okay, now he gets drunk, at his restaurant, in Malibu. He gets stopped, and he comes out with a tremendous amount of racial slurs against the Jewish community and the Jews. What was your reaction, David, when, and I'm being in California, you're out there in his backyard, basically. What was your reaction when all this stuff started happening?
Well, for one thing, on one level, I thought it was hilarious. And the reason is, it's very rare that something happens where someone literally completely baldly and unapologetically reveals what they're really thinking, and that I guess that's the glory of alcohol. It was one of those moments where, for years, I guess Passion of Christ came out last year or the year before.
Exactly,
that.
Right.
Everyone defending the film, particularly from the extreme right wing, the religious right, and even some people, Jewish voices said, well, Mel Gibson is in his heart of hearts, he couldn't possibly be anti-Semitic, and anything in the film that implies anti-Semitism is not intentional and not really there, and deriding people who would even hint that would be the case. All of these things. Actually, one columnist out here quoted all these people from back then saying, all these things about Mel Gibson not having an anti-Semitic bone in his body, and yada yada yada, and other people saying, look, let's see down the road, what this film really does and what Mel Gibson really does. And here he comes out, and with the help of alcohol, basically lets the world know exactly what he was thinking and exactly what his intent was with the film. It's unimpeachable that was his perspective. And I just think it's very rare that you get a chance for, it would be like George Bush, one of these moments when the microphone's turned off and he says, these idiots think we're actually trying to bring democracy to the Middle East, when Ronald Reagan, when he thought the mic was turned off, declared war on the Soviet Union. These moments are very, very rare, and there's something to treasure, when the truth is revealed so clearly.
Yeah, and it's like you say, I did an interview with Dr. Mo, he's a podcaster on Podomatic. And his comment to me was, how was I reacting to it, and my comment to him, and I think you'll agree, when someone has alcohol in their system, David, it really brings down their fences. Don't you agree?
Oh, yeah.
So I mean, my personal opinion, and I assume from what you said that you share that opinion. You know, if someone is prejudiced about the Jews, the blacks, you know, the Chinese, whoever, if they're prejudiced and they have this fence up and they drink alcohol, all those fences come down and they say what they really feel. I believe Mel Gibson can't stand the Jews. I mean, that's my opinion.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's, you know, kind of the idea that when you're drunk you say things you don't really mean is ridiculous. You know, it's kind of like, you know, when you're hypnotized, no one can make you do something that you wouldn't agree to do otherwise. And it's the same thing when people are drunk. And I think, and just one thing about that is that I think that the issue really is not Mel Gibson's personal opinion about Jews. It's the fact that that film was a vicious attack on Jews to begin with, and secondly, you know, I guess, you know, a kind of a vision of, a, you know, kind of that goes very well with the kind of apocalyptic Christianity that, and I'm not criticizing Christianity as a whole, but the political apocalyptic, you know, views that are kind of running this country right now, and I think that's really kind of the issue. By all rights, his tirade should put to rest anyone, you know, claiming that's not the case. Certainly about the anti-Semitism, but
yeah.
Of course it doesn't.
Yeah, and I totally agree. Okay, now speaking of the Jewish community and Jews, what's your take on the Israeli-Lebanon scenario? I mean, you know, I made a comment to somebody on an interview some time ago when they asked me what I thought. And I told them that I thought that, you know, there is no way in hell that Israel and Lebanon are ever going to get to a point to where they're going to go, well, you guys, you know, let's be friends. You guys stay over there and we'll stay over here. My opinion and my opinion only, and I want your comments on this, David. My opinion is that it will never in a million years happen, and that I don't care what they try to negotiate, that there's going to be somebody that's going to get pissed off on one side or the other, and ultimately, sooner or later, there's going to be a holy war of some massive scale. Now, that's my opinion. David, what do you think?
Well, I'm fairly similar to that, but I think just kind of backing away a little bit and looking at it from a political perspective, I don't think you can understand what happened with Israel invading Lebanon outside of the context of two things. One, the current kind of agenda that the Bush administration has towards the entire Middle East. And two, the overall role that Israel has played for decades in the Middle East and is clearly very willing to play now as, I think, in many ways, kind of the American henchman in that region. I think, you know, just there's a couple basic facts that I think that certainly no one in the administration denies, which is that the United States now has a policy of completely reshaping the Middle East and the Gulf. And now, if anyone thinks that the goal of reshaping that region is to bring democracy and freedom to the people, then you have to kind of confront a whole lot of thorny questions, like, you know, why is Saudi Arabia the biggest ally of the United States when it is the most undemocratic fundamentalist government in the region, and why is it that when Hezbollah in Lebanon gets elected to government and Hamas in Palestine gets elected to government, the United States joins with Israel to bomb and kill as many people as they can in those areas in order to destroy those organizations? It's what's going on in the Middle East, both from the United States perspective and from Israel's perspective, is not spreading democracy. It's spreading control and power and reshaping that region as, I think, as an American outpost. And I think Israel is pretty much, you know, is very much part of that. As a Jewish person, I have to say, for me, this has been the case since the 1960s, that I don't think I can say strongly enough how much I hate what Israel has done. not only to that region of the world, but frankly, to my own identification with being Jewish, and to millions of people like that, because I think, as one person put it, I think Israel is the second worst thing that's ever happened to the Jewish people. I don't think Israel is a product of Jewishness. Israel is a product of a political agenda of Zionism and of kind of establishing a Western style outpost in that region. And I don't believe that there's a question of equality between Israel and Palestine or Israel and Lebanon. That I think Israel, I believe very much that Israel's goal with the Palestinian people is fundamentally the same goal that the Americans had with the Native American people in this country. They will not. I don't believe Israel will rest until Palestinians are completely denuded as a nation, and I think that's a horrendous thing. I'm obviously very upset by that. Israel invaded Lebanon not because Hezbollah was lobbing rockets into Israel or attacking Israeli people. They hadn't for the past 10 years. Actually, I heard a professor, former American military colonel, on Fresh Air recently, who's an expert on the Middle East. He said Hezbollah in the last 10 years was responsible for the death of one Israeli civilian. And meanwhile, Israel has been bombing and bombarding southern Lebanon pretty much continuously for that time. So this was not a case of Israel defending itself. This was a case of lashing out in an attempt to destroy a very legitimate political force in the region that Israel doesn't want to and cannot live with.
So in other words, you really agree with my position that sooner or later, I mean, there's never going to be a time to where they're going to sit there and go, okay, let's all live our lives in harmony. You don't think that's going to happen, right?
It's hard to foresee how that would happen, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. All right. When we were driving down to the farmer's market, when we were going to meet Tim with the Iraqi Veterans Against the War, which was a great lunch, I thought, we were discussing your background, which I knew a little bit about, David. But, my perspective of the Vietnam involvement was from the military side, and yours, of course, was from the civilian side. But just tell people briefly, how you got started. I know you first got involved with the Oleo Strut, but what got you motivated to where that's what you wanted to do? And I thought when you and I discussed this in your car going for lunch with Tim, I thought it was a very interesting story, and I don't think people know about it and would like to hear that. So bring me up to speed, like when you dropped, I think you dropped out of college, and where you went to get to the Oleo Strut.
Okay. I got to go back a little bit farther for that, just to kind of, I don't think what I did was all that untypical, of the time. I graduated high school in 1967, and I was determined then I wanted to drop out. I wanted to kind of go off and be an artist, a folk singer, a songwriter, something that I had kind of aspired to ever since I started high school. So I went off and started kind of bumming around the country, and I ended up in Europe kind of romantic, youthful idea of how I was going to live my life. I worked on a farm. I worked on a boat. I was I was a street singer. All these things, and all this time, I was really trying to ignore what was going on in the world and in the war. I really wanted to avoid it, and just like the situation today. I mean, you couldn't do that for very long. I mean, I tried hard. I kind of wanted to live my own life, and when I finally came back to this country in 1969, by then, I really had kind of reached a point where I just couldn't do it anymore. I mean, you couldn't open a newspaper, you couldn't look around or move without being affected in some way by the Vietnam War. And it was a time when people were, you know, kind of dividing up, and it was very a period when increasingly, you know, things were polarized. And ultimately, that was kind of, I think that was a good thing, because it made for a very, on one level, pretty exciting, you know, times in this country. But I, you know, had promised my parents I'd go to college. So I'd been accepted out of high school at the University of California up in Santa Cruz. And so I went up there in the fall. And, you know, I on college campuses then, you know, even more so, you simply could not avoid the war and the politics around it and the upheaval that was going on around it. Although it wasn't quite as universal as some people think. I mean, there were plenty of college students who supported the war or who kind of were staying out of it. But I, by then, was really kind of diving in. And at a certain point, very quickly, I realized that college wasn't the place to be if you were serious about joining with a real political movement that could end that war. You had to go where that was happening, kind of at the front lines. And I ran into some people who worked at the Oleostra, which was the coffee house that was set up outside Fort Hood in Killeen, which is a town of about 30,000 people in the middle of Texas, and as you know.
Yeah, know it well.
Middle of nowhere.
Yeah, so middle of nowhere is like it's as close to an Iraqi desert.
Yeah, exactly. Locust invasions and everything. Next thing I knew, I was traveling in a 64 Chevy with a couple of crazy vets who were driving about 150 miles an hour down Highway 35, and believing at that moment that I was going to die within the next 6 months, and trying to figure out why I had done this. And I ended up spending about 2.5 years down there, and it's funny, you know, after 35 years you kind of filter out some of the horrible parts of your youth, but you know, because a lot of it was miserable and boring, and we had absolutely no money, would work. I was a carpenter. I work all day as a carpenter, and then work late into the night at the Oleo Strut. But you know, I think people who were around back then, and this happens a lot, but I think it was really, really happening big back then. You know, when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, you know, the world, the universe revolves around you. And I think, you know, in many ways, we really did feel like down there in that, you know, godforsaken town of Killeen, Texas, we really were the center of the universe. And that was an exaggeration. But frankly, what was going on with the GIs, with the soldiers at that time, in their thousands by then, by 1970, 71, 72, refusing to go along with that war was monumental. It was absolutely monumental, and I think it had a huge impact on the war and on the military and on the country as a whole.
Okay, but now before we get into what really happened in the military, which you and I both know from different perspectives, you know, one thing that I really find amazing and interesting is when you told me that, you know, Sir No Sir really was a labor of love and a monumental and personal investment on your part because of something you so believed in. But you told me in the car, David, that, which really actually blew me away, that it was a lot of your friends and that really, you know, pushed you over the line, so to speak, to get you to do this movie. Now, is that pretty accurate?
That's absolutely true. I didn't want to make this movie. I did not want to jump back into the political fray. I haven't considered myself a political activist since the mid-1980s. My personal life has gone through some pretty horrific crises, and I kind of was on the bottom and had to start over, and I had started over, and when I started my life over in the 80s, I started as a photographer and then went on to start making films, and I don't consider myself to be a, quote, political, end quote, filmmaker. I'm not a propagandist. I'm not out here trying to make films that are going to impact politically. I'm trying to make films that are going to be, you know, emotionally satisfying and revealing about, you know, human nature and people and life today and all of those kind of things. I really, you know, did not want to make a film that was going to be a lightning rod or to make a film that people were going to take as a political scribe or something like that. And I was also scared. I mean, I'll say it straight up, and I don't think I'm that unusual. For me, when 9/11 happened and the response was an immediate invasion of Afghanistan, and a clear, you know, declaration by our government that we're going into, you know, decades of war, and that what people thought was freedom in this country was going to be curtailed and even, you know, set aside. I wasn't particularly that wasn't exactly the kind of climate for me where I wanted to jump right in and be a, you know, a flaming radical.
Yeah.
But it also, what I ended up realizing and what, you know, in the course of people really arguing with me to make the film was that, you know, obviously, first of all, telling the story now is something that really, you know, needs to be part of the climate, part of what people are confronting when they try to figure out what the reality is about what's happening today and what you're going to do about it. But there's also a thing that I've carried with me ever since then, which is that, you know, this was my life, you know, for many years. This was the lives of thousands of people for many years, and it's been, I'm talking about the GI movement now.
Exactly.
I'm talking about what happened in the late 60s, early 70s, and it has been ridiculed and buried and ignored and, literally rewritten out of history for 30, 35 years. And the fact that I was able in this film to kind of put this thing and put my own life and the lives of everyone who was involved in this, a lot of them who I consider to be my best friends, you know, from all of my life.
Exactly.
Put that back on the stage of history where it belongs, ended up being really, really satisfying.
Well, okay.
It took a lot to get me to make the film.
Okay, and so let's now that we're there at that point, let's discuss this briefly. I did three tours of the Republic of Vietnam, as you well know, from 1968 to 1971, and went into the military on my birthday, August 15th, 1967. In fact, you and I graduated the same year, seniors 67. Actually, I wanted to fail 2 years so I could have a ring that said 69 on it, but that didn't go over well with my parents. So anyway, From my perspective, David, I'm going to give you my insight, because your insight is keen and it's from the civilian standpoint, if you will, or what you observed as a filmmaker. But, you know, when I was in the military, there was definitely an air of we didn't want to go to Vietnam. We didn't really want to be involved in that process. We didn't want to die. I mean, you know, that was the majority of the people's opinions that I met, while I was in the Air Force. And, when I got in Vietnam, even though it was a volunteer deal, because I hated the Strategic Air Force, and that was the only way I could get off the SAC base. But, I mean, you know, that said, you know, I mean, I did three tours, you know, basically back to back, with little time in between. And as each tour progressed, I'm talking about from 1968 to 69, when I was at Cameron Bay, 69, 70, when I was at Phan Rang, and then, of course, finishing up my tours in my military career, if you will, from 70 to 71, when I was in Saigon at Tan Sanut Air Base. As each year progressed, David, I saw more and more chaotic behavior by the soldiers. But when I saw Sir No Sir, and I've told you this before, and you thought it was very interesting and had some keen observations about it, when I saw the movie, honestly, I was blown away. I've told people this before in interviews. I've also said this in articles, that I was blown away because what I saw in the military, at least in the Air Force, now I'm sure Army and Marines were a lot different, but from the Air Force perspective, I saw a lot of anti-war things, but I never saw the things that the film depicts. So can you give me some kind of insight based upon your knowledge and the things that you were involved with from the film process, really what you thought was going on in the military from an observer's standpoint?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that what went on in the military happened on a lot of different levels. And I think the level that was very plainly out there and that everyone kind of recognized and in some way became part of was the level that you're talking about, the sense of, first off, going from, you know, I don't want to die, to going over there and at the very minimum saying, what the hell are we doing here? I mean, this, you know, this is crazy. This is ridiculous. This is, you know, we're not, you know, I mean, I think very few people would not say at the minimum, it was pretty clear when you were over there that the Vietnamese people were not exactly your friends. I mean, as far as this idea that the enemy, you know, was the people.
Exactly.
You know, that you know, there's this kind of standard thing that, you know, yeah, the guy who cuts your hair during the day will cut your throat at night.
which was my case. You know, they killed my barber coming through the fence line when I was at Phan Rang. So, I mean, that's a perfect example. You know, you don't know who your friends or your enemies are over there.
Right. And it became clear that this was not, you know, a war, you know, that the Vietnamese people wanted the United States there. So, you know, just on a very minimum basis, the whole question of what in the world is the point of this war, I think was pretty widespread. Now, then there were other levels that happened. There were people who took it a step further and said, wait a minute, the whole point of this war is to dominate these people, is to control this area, it's it's not defeating communism, it's spreading American power. And a lot of, you know, I mean, there was a smaller groups of people who began to kind of, began to take that position. And if you remember back then, you know, there was a whole lot of radical political literature out there for people to get.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the underground press especially.
Well, the underground press especially, even, you know, kind of the underground press outside the military, and it was even penetrating, you know, Playboy magazine and, you know, a lot of publications that a lot of people read. And a lot of people, you know, this was a time when people began kind of looking for answers. You know, why is this going on? Why are we, you know, why is there this, you know, huge battle going on in America over civil rights, you know, and black people still, you know, fighting just to have a modicum of freedom.
Exactly.
And yet the military, you know, 20% of the ground troops, 30% of the ground troops are black, African American, and among the black troops, the question of, you know, what are we fighting for and who should we be fighting became a pretty, you know, pretty widespread question. So what happened was, you know, and again, this was on a different level or in a different way than the overall sentiment, groups would start to organize and put out newspapers. Now, the thing about it that made it so interesting to me is that none of this was, or there were only a couple cases of where people trying to form like national organizations that would link, you know, the GIs from all over the world and
right.
Whatever. For the most part, this was like, if you happen to be at Fort Hood in 1970, 71, 72, you would have read the Fatigue Press, or you would have gone to the Oleo Strut, or you would have, ultimately, as over 3,000 GIs did, you would have participated in a demonstration against the war.
Exactly.
But if you weren't someplace where that kind of level of organization existed, then you couldn't be. You know, there was nothing to link up with. There was nothing to kind of get involved with. So, it happened in different places constantly, you know, and a few guys would get together on such and such base and start up an underground newspaper, and then the base would, transfer these guys to other bases. These guys at Fort Bragg, we'll send them out to Fort Benning.
Yeah, they wanted to get rid of the radical guys.
Huh?
They wanted to get rid of the radical guys.
Well, yeah, they'd get rid of them, but all that would happen is that the next thing you know, there'd be an underground newspaper at Fort Benning. I mean, they would just kind of, like, scatter it, you know what I mean? And it wasn't until, like, 1972 that the Army in particular just realized, look, the best thing we can do is just get rid of these people. And they were ETS and guys, people in droves.
I mean, right.
By 1972, I think, no matter how much time you had left in the Army, at least, the minute you set foot back in the States from Vietnam, you were out. They just said, you know, goodbye. Because the biggest problems that were happening were in the States were from Vietnam returnees, were from both draftees and enlistees who had anywhere from 6 months to 18 months still to serve after their tour of duty in Vietnam, and came back angry and wanting to stop the war, a lot of them, and wanting to get back at the military. You know, it's interesting, the anger that people felt for the most part, and I'm not saying this is true of everyone, but for a fairly significant percentage of people, was at the government and the military. And, you know, in the last 30 years, that anger has been twisted and turned into anger at the American, you know, at the left, at the anti-war movement. And that's another issue. But I think the answer is that it really kind of, you know, it happened on many different levels, you know, and there really was an overall breakdown in morale and in fighting capacity.
Right.
And then on the next level up, there was an actual significant minority of people who became organizers and radicals and did everything they could to end the war. Like in the Air Force, the guys in the film, the guys who were the interpreters who were spying on North Vietnamese radio communications, who all of them, because directly they kept hearing these radio communications about civilian areas and hospitals being hit by bombs and by American bombs, and then the United States government, you know, denying that any civilian areas are targeted. And these guys almost universally turned against the war and put out a newspaper and organized against it, and there was even a work stoppage where they simply refused to participate in the Christmas bombing in 1972. Now, no one knew about this other than the people who participated in it, because these guys were basically, they were released from the military and told if they ever told anyone, they'd be prosecuted for treason.
Exactly, and, right.
So, you know, there was a lot of these things that literally were hidden until we were able to bring them out in the film.
Okay, now here's an interesting question, David. All right, you know, I mean, obviously, from a historical perspective, I mean, the Vietnam War, everybody knew about it, and I mean, it's in history books and whatever. Why do you think the government covered it up from what the real facts that happened in the Vietnam War and replaced it with this hippie spitting myth controversy thing?
There was a very clear kind of juncture, I think, that happened with the Reagan administration, with the election of Ronald Reagan, who, you know, if you remember back in the mid '70s, the first time Ronald Reagan ran for president, it's kind of similar to the whole Bush thing. First time Ronald Reagan ran for president, he was roundly ridiculed as being a nut. He was a, you know, super right wing nut, you know, who A, didn't have a chance in hell of being president, and B, you know, would probably destroy the world if he did get elected. And, of course, he did get elected, right?
Exactly.
Under the Reagan administration, under his leadership, the right wing, and sometimes these terms get a little bit weird because they get too all-inclusive, but there really is a very strong, extreme kind of right wing in this country, who had obviously never accepted the defeat in Vietnam and had, you know, bigger plans for future wars, particularly in Latin America, that part of you know, remember Reagan coined the term the Vietnam Syndrome.
Exactly.
Which was, in his point of view and in the point of view of the right wing, the so-called syndrome that where the American people didn't want to fight any more wars like Vietnam, as if this was some kind of a disease that you wouldn't want to fight any more wars like Vietnam. And he very much set about trying to reverse the Vietnam Syndrome. And a big part of that was the Honor the Vets campaign that was headed up by General Westmoreland, who was, you know, universally hated in Vietnam when he was in charge of troops in Vietnam, who then became this, you know, this heroic spokesman for Vietnam vets who were shamefully, in this viewpoint, were shamefully ignored when they came home. And they took the very real problems that Vietnam vets had when they came home and turned them into a tool to promote a very right-wing agenda, which is the American people have got to support their troops when they're in the field, no matter what. And it's kind of another way of saying the term that got ridiculed in the 60s, my country, right or wrong. You know, it's
exactly.
My troops, right or wrong, became kind of the rallying cry. Now, if that's the rallying cry and if that's how you're going to kind of reshape not only the history of Vietnam, but the future that these guys had in store, then the image of GIs coming home wearing peace signs, giving the clenched fist, joining demonstrations, throwing their medals in anger onto the Capitol steps as 1,500 Vietnam veterans did in the 1971 Vietnam Veterans Against the War demonstration. None of these things can fit very well into that kind of a picture. You have to have loyal troops, you know, coming home having fought. But you have to have Rambo. I mean, that's when Rambo came up, you know, and became this huge phenomenon. That's the kind of image that you have to present of the war in Vietnam.
And they did a very good job with the Rambo series. I mean, you know, I mean, I remember, I mean, watching Rambo and him going through his tirade, talking to the major, you know, talking about, you know, coming into the airports and being spit on and whatever. And then, of course, as the movie depicts, you know, you have one of the main characters that wrote books, did research and whatever, and found out there is no way that this could possibly happen.
Right. I mean, it's not, I mean, basically what he found out and what we have in the film is the fact that the stories about veterans coming home and being spat on at the San Francisco airport in particular are very questionable. And by the way, the point's never made that there never was a case of something like this happening. There could have been, but for the most part, the evidence that this is a myth that was kind of promulgated, you know, often by very, you know, kind of by, for one thing, by in Hollywood and by very kind of right wing kind of forces, you know, is very strong. I mean, it was, no one ever claimed back then that it happened. You know, no one ever claimed any of this happened until the late 1970s, when suddenly, I think it first appeared in the G.I. Joe comics. I mean, the hallmark of an urban myth is that no one claims it happened until many years later, and a lot of memories have been kind of twisted and perverted. And Jerry Lemke, who wrote that book, debunking the myth, it's interesting because since he wrote the book, he's always getting contacted by people saying, this isn't true, I know this happened, it happened to a friend of mine, or even that it happened to me. And then when he's kind of talked to people and confronted them and kind of tried to get some evidence or whatever, generally the stories tend to dissolve into, well, no, I didn't get spat on, but I sure got treated bad, you know. And,
yeah.
Pretty big difference, by the way.
Well, you know, I said this in an article that I did on Above Top Secret. There was a time that I was spat on, but it was at a private party, and, you know, there was a free flowing of alcohol, And some girl happened to see my ring and say, you know, where'd you graduate from? And, of course, being the comedic person that I am, I said, University of Saigon. And, you know, she did, stand up. And I think this is after all the My Lai scenarios happened and whatever. And she was very angry young lady. She didn't really, I don't think she spat on me. I think she threw a drink in my face. Which was liquid. But, I thought it was a very interesting part of the movie because no military person ever goes to San Francisco Airport or do they go to LAX. They have to go to Travis.
Right. When people return from Vietnam, there were isolated cases of flights getting diverted to San Francisco, but then, you know, in most cases it was a matter of, you know, flying into Travis and getting processed out and then, you know, going on your way. And so, you know, that aspect of it is a very, you know, very, very questionable. The idea that, you know, you were met on the tarmac by some hippie chick who was there for the sole purpose of spitting on you, you know, that becomes a lot of things. And, you know, and the thing is, you have to kind of look at what's the political message of that. You know, for one thing, the 1960s were a very, very volatile time. And it's not like, you know, when people are being killed by the thousands weekly, you know, it tends to be not a time for polite, you know, cocktail conversation. People get in pretty heated arguments about it, you know.
Exactly.
And I think rightly so. You know, I remember reading this one guy talking about, you know, how, well, when he got back, he'd been a lieutenant or something, and he came back and he went to school at Berkeley, and he felt very uncomfortable supporting the war and defending the war at Berkeley. Well, you know, and he's kind of attributing that to the fact that he was a veteran. Well, it had nothing to do with the fact that he's a veteran. I mean, no one on the Berkeley campus who supported the war was going to be very comfortable at that time, you know, because the feelings were very strongly against it. And so this has become really very much a tool of, well, you look at it today, it's a tool of the people who adamantly support the war and who make it a mantra to whenever someone opposes the war to immediately say, aha, you're symbolically spitting on the troops. You're blaming the troops. You're not supporting the troops, which is incredibly ironic because, you know, the claims of not only the anti-war movement back in the 60s, but the GI movement and the veterans movement were not that such as My Lai. They did one of two things. First, they tried to cover them up, and recently in the LA Times, they've had a series where a whole wide range of atrocities had been investigated and covered up by the military during the Vietnam War. But then when they get exposed, what does the government and the military do? They blame it on the troops. They
exactly.
say, well, it was those cunts. It was that sergeant. It was that captain. And the people who formulate the policy, the people who order people into that situation, who order people in Abu Ghraib to terrify the prisoners, those people, you know, are never prosecuted, and they're in fact the ones who blame the troops.
Exactly.
Who try to hide behind their own policies, and it's incredibly hypocritical what goes on with that, and I think, but at the same time, it's been a very effective weapon and kind of in putting having a real chilling effect on people opposing things like torture.
Exactly. You know, and speaking of myths or debunking myths or whatever, you know, one of the emails that I got, David, which I thought was very interesting, and from my military perspective, I saw a tremendous amount of it. I'm just wondering, when you were doing the film together, and you were putting everything together and doing the interviews, there's a couple of things in the DVD that I think were very interesting. And where I'm heading with this is Ebony Ivory, the black and white racial tension in Vietnam. There's a part in the movie that I want you to kind of explain a bit. You've told me personally, but it's not really plain in the movie of what it's really about, and that is there's a scene in the movie where there is with the FTA, I think it's in the FTA movie, but they're videoing a group of African American people, and it's just not plain who these people are. And obviously they're saying, we're not going to fight the white man's war, and we're not going to do this, we're not going to do that. And I want to discuss this a little bit, but I want you to tell the listeners really what that was all about and who those folks were.
Well, that scene was, as you said, it was part of the film called FTA, that was a film about the there was a anti-war music and skit review. It was put together by Donald Sutherland, Jane Fonda, a number of other performers, actors, and singers that traveled all over, first the U.S. and then Asia, performing for tens of thousands of troops who wildly applauded and loved the show. It was a very anti-war, very radical show. And at the, you know, while they were on tour, they would have conversations with and interviews with a lot of the GIs. And this one meeting that they had, it was with, I think there's 20, 25 guys in that meeting. They're all Marines. And this is at Okinawa or somewhere like that. And they're talking very, as you said, very militantly about that black people should not be fighting in Vietnam. Black people should be fighting on the streets of America, you know. This reflected, you know, the increasingly militant sentiment among African American soldiers. It was a very, very stark contradiction that people faced. I think it was most poignantly talked about in the film by I forgot his name all of a sudden. It just went out of my head. Anyway, but this guy was a black GI, a guy who had enlisted in the Marines with Terry Whitmore's.
Yeah, Terry. Terry.
Very,
yeah.
Good soldier, you know, like high scores and everything. Very gung-ho, went to Vietnam, was in some intense battles, ended up wounded and in Japan in the hospital. And while he's in the hospital recovering, he's watching on the television as federal troops, army troops, are being sent into Memphis, his hometown. This is in the wake of the assassination of Martin Luther King. This is where he's from. This is where his wife and daughter are. He's seeing, you know, our army troops marching through Memphis, shooting at people. And here he is in the hospital, and he receives his orders back to Vietnam. And it became an unlivable contradiction, an unlivable situation for him to go back and fight in Vietnam for this country while this country was sending troops into the ghettos, into the cities, all over the United States.
Exactly.
Suppressing black people, was an untenable situation. And I think that concentrated what was faced by millions of black people, and including inside the military. And it got very sharp inside the military. There were, in Germany, race riots and rebellions in every... just about every base in Germany. You got to remember, by the way, the military back then, the officer corps of the military was largely Southern white.
Exactly.
These are people who were in the officer corps had been in the military for, you know, 10 to 20 to 30 years. These guys came in during the 50s. When the military was largely still basically segregated, there was hardly any African American officers, and these guys were Southern, you know, often very racist. There were a lot of situations in Vietnam where you know, people would hang, you know, white soldiers would hang Confederate flags, you know, at their barracks, and black soldiers would hang the Black Panther flag or something like that.
Oh, yeah, and I saw a lot of that myself, especially as the tours that I did progress. Really, the first time, David, that I saw it, and I know from the civilian standpoint it was probably different, but the first time I really that it really registered with me was when I was at Fan Rang, and I saw African-American soldiers wearing the weaved bracelets, which was a black bracelet, and they would wear these weaved black crosses around their neck. And, you know, it really got to a point to where there could have very easily been, and you pointed it out in the comments you made, it could have very easily been a scenario to where there was a race riot or a race war within the Vietnam War itself. Now, it never happened that I saw, but I'm positive that there were instances to where you had that scenario of black versus white in a war zone.
Well, you know, yes, and I think it mainly happened in the rear areas, from what I understand. But there was another aspect of this, which was that, and I saw this at Fort Hood. We ran it. We had you know, the situation there where, you know, it would kind of go back and forth between, you know, unity between the black soldiers and the anti-war white soldiers. Which, you know, became, in, particularly in Vietnam, you know, there was a, you know, if, you know, things got kind of divided into the, there were the juicers who were, the, you know, tended to be the lifers, almost all white, who listened to, this is kind of a, this was a bit of a, big, generalization, but, you know, there, it's, there were the, you know, the juicers were the white lifers and white GIs from the South who listened to country music and got drunk, and then there were the dopers, right, who, you know, largely white GIs who smoked dope and listened to Radio First Termer. And, you know,
a lot of them were doing that.
And the brothers. And the brothers, you know, generally, would often, you know, identify with and hang out with the dopers. And that's a lot of how things broke down. And it took on at different points, it took on very political characteristic of, you know, the dopers and brothers being very, you know, much against the war and joining the Vietnam Veterans Against the War and joining the Black Panthers, or it became a thing of doing everything they can to prevent the lifers from putting them in harm's way. You know, there's the term that became popular was what is it? Rather than search and destroy, it was search and evade or something, where
yeah.
You know, you go out on patrol, get out about 100 yards, and you know, set up a little camp and get stoned for the rest of the day, and then come back in and report that you didn't see any enemy. And you know, but then on the other side, you know, we're, like you said, there was a fairly a lot of kind of more southern oriented and maybe more kind of pro-America, pro-war, no matter what, groupings. And yeah, it got very hostile at different times.
Okay, now, you know, while we're on the subject of hostilities, here we go. You know, we've got Iraq. We've kind of briefly, you know, touched on that there is another war going on, you know, right now, other than Israel and Lebanon. But, you know, we're coming up in just a few weeks. Charlie Cooper, Nadira, the retired Captain Panzi, his lover Ralph, Omar bin Fucking, and, you know, a few of the crew guys. We're going to go to Baghdad, Iraq, to do the Radio First Term Iraq show. Now, here's a scenario, David. I mean, we've got the Iraq war, and, you know, my observation, I've made this very, very plain in postings that I've done and also in interviews that I've done, that I see a tremendous amount of similarities between Vietnam and Iraq, especially when it comes to escalation. And just recently, several weeks ago, you know, the military slash governmental conglomerate makes a decision that they want to make Baghdad safer. So they decide that they're going to bring in a lot more troops, and they're going to begin this house-to-house search. Well, you know, I mean, I immediately had a flashback to Vietnam when they were making the decisions, well, you know, we're really making a lot of progress there, but we're going to bring in a couple of 100,000 other guys, and, you know, which is going to make the job faster. Well, as you and I both know, and history has proved out, that, you know, all that does is create more animosity to the host or the country that we're helping. And number two, it creates a tremendous amount of more casualties of the U.S. military or the military of the allies that are there. So here's a question. Did we really learn anything from Vietnam, David? And if we did, why is it relevant today?
Well, the first thing you got to do is you got to ask yourself, what do you mean by we? You know, what's the, you know, the old...
Tonto, the old Tonto thing.
What do you mean we?
Yeah. What do you mean we, Tonto?
Yeah. I mean, there's different we's in the ball in the ball game here, you know? I mean, there is the we, which is the kind of represented by the Bush administration and the Project for New American Century that you know, which is what the kind of Bible that was written in the early 90s by these folks, you know, about how we're going to recreate the world in America's image. What they learned from the Vietnam War, I think, which is very scary, is that to the extent that they, if you want to call it learning something, was that but that, you know, you have to be even more ruthless and more willing to sacrifice tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of lives, both American and, you know, in this case Iraqi, in that case Vietnamese, in order to win. I mean, I think this is what these people learn. These people, you know, and it's very, very scary. I think the other thing that they learned from it is that you have to find every way you can to undercut any kind of movement against the war that you're fighting, and that's where a lot of this the spitting myth comes in, and the fact that they are determined by hook or by crook to not have to reinstitute the draft. You know,
exactly.
I think the other we here is, for lack of a better word, the people. You know, it's us. It's those of us who are confronted with this and have to decide what we're going to do about it. And I think we have a lot to learn from Vietnam, and in particular, in this case, from the GI movement. You know, and that is that soldiers, you know, are human beings and can understand right from wrong. You know. But as far as historical lessons about, you know, when an empire comes in to occupy a country, you know, I mean, I'll tell you what, for one thing, this idea that, okay, we're different because we're bringing democracy is such a ludicrous, ridiculous concept.
It is.
No empire has ever claimed anything other than that. You know, they've always, you know, what it, you know, the Spanish brought civilization to America. The British brought, you know, the glories of British culture to India. You know, I mean, all of these things have always been in the name of progress. And the idea that, you know, it is very scary because I think that the so-called lessons that the government is acting on are exactly the wrong lessons to be acting on, and they're the ones that are going to create the world and make the world much more dangerous. You know, in Vietnam, what did they do to try to solve the problem of civilians supporting the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese? They destroyed the villages. They literally went in with the Strategic Hamlet program, took everyone out of the villages, burned the villages down, and put everyone in concentration camps.
Exactly.
What are they doing in Iraq? They're destroying entire towns. They're going into Fallujah and places like that, and they're demolishing people's lives in the name of protecting them from, you know, from their own people.
Exactly.
You know, it's absolutely horrendous, and it will not lead to anything more than, you know, than just constant increases in the slaughter.
Yeah, and you know, I made a comment when I did an interview with, I think, some of the guys in Philadelphia. You know, we were just discussing, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's me, but you know, when you hear people say, hey, we don't mind the United States coming in and getting rid of Osama and some of the idiots, But, you know, once you're in and once you've gotten rid of those guys and you've kind of established our own little government kind of thing, you know, get the hell out and let us, you know, run our country. What I think creates the animosity is we go in, we're there, we get rid of the bad guy, and instead of saying, okay, here you go, guys, here's your country, you know, we back out and, you know, let them run their country. And I think that's what pisses a lot of the Iraqi people off.
Well, because, and I think you have to look at that, and you have to then reexamine the question of why did the U.S. go in there? Did the U.S. go in there to get rid of a bad guy, or did the U.S. go in there because they saw the opportunity to turn Iraq into an American outpost? And I think the only way you can look at what's gone on in that war that makes any sense whatsoever is if you accept the fact that the goal of the United States has nothing to do with ending a dictatorship. It has everything to do with dominating that region.
Exactly. Well, I tell you, this has been an absolute joy for me. And
hopefully your listeners too.
Well, you know, hopefully there's not, you know, Dave Rabbit and David Zeiger pictures on the wall or throwing darts at us. But before I say goodbye to David, I want to remind everybody to go to David's site at www.sirnosir.com. Go to the storefront and purchase what I think is going to be an absolute collector's item. And you're going to regret if you don't get this DVD, I'm telling you, because this is going to really skyrocket over the next few years, I think, because it's going to be, you know, people are going to go back and look at this and say, you know, well, we should have learned something from this movie. We should have learned something from Vietnam. And I think anybody that doesn't buy this DVD is really missing the boat here, especially since David's got some really great buys. I mean, you know, the DVD itself is like, you know, $19.95 if you just buy it singularly. But if you get it coupled with the audio CD, which is regularly $13.95, I mean, you basically save, you know, several bucks and just pay $29.95. So you save about $4 by getting the DVD and the CD together. And I guarantee you, you're going to want to hear this CD, because if you enjoy just kind of the tidbits that were going on in the movie, you're really going to enjoy hearing Buddy Judge, the Creepers, the Shirelles, especially. I mean, if nothing else is worth the price of the soundtrack alone, it's Rita Martinson. And I guarantee you, yeah, and I mean, when I did the premiere for David here in Dallas, was there for four or five of the shows, which we had absolute tremendous turnout, and it was just an unbelievable experience. I can't thank David enough for that. But looking in the audience's eyes when Rita Martinson is doing the song, even on the movie, people got misty-eyed. And it's just really such an impactful, such a really important audio piece that I think that alone is worth the price.
Yep. That song should be really kind of out there in the world now, you know, in a way that it's never been. You know, I want to say one last thing about the film, and that is that, you know, if anyone out there, you know, listening to this, I mean, I don't expect everyone to agree with everything or most or even half of what we've been saying or what I've been saying, or even agree that the GI movement was a good thing, you know, was something that should have happened or not. But I would say, you know, no matter what your political point of view, and no matter what you think of this war in Iraq or the war in Lebanon or what's going on with the Bush administration, you should watch the film, because there's nothing in this film that isn't, you know, well documented, and simply there's nothing in this film that didn't really happen. And I think everyone, a lot of reviewers have pointed this out, whatever your political point of view, you got to recognize what happened and kind of decide what you think about it. And not just decide what you think about it, but decide what you think it means for today.
And I think that pretty much sums it up, because it's like I said before, when I first saw the movie or even knew about the movie, I know we're continuing on with the interview, but I don't care. Hey, it's my show, by God. If I want to continue on a few more minutes, I will. But, when I first found out that David had used some of the audio clips from Radio First Tremor when we were in Saigon, it blew me away. And, it really fit right in with what the movie was about, which was, about the anti-war movement of GIs as well as civilians. But this is the story about the GI movement and how they, I believe, and I know David believes this too, that if the GIs hadn't done what they did, there would be literally hundreds more lives that would have been lost, both civilian and military. And it just goes to show what a group of people can do when they set their mind to it. And this is such an important film. This is back to what I was saying. When I first saw the movie, David sent me a kind of a preview copy before it was even released. And I sat there and watched the movie. I got tears in my eyes because it's been 35 years ago. And it rekindled thoughts. It rekindled memories that I had from my time in the Air Force and my time in the military. And it blew me away. It really blew me away.
Well, I appreciate that.
David, you're such a great, it's like I said before, and I want to say it again on this podcast, meeting you was just absolutely a highlight for Dave Rabbit and our family. And, you were just such a very kind, a very generous, a very sweet person. Your lovely wife and your two daughters are just absolutely a joy. We had such a great time in California and being a part of David Zeiger's life for at least one day. And I just can't thank you enough. And if you would hold on just for a second, David, I want to do my little stock ending here, and then I want to say goodbye to you on a personal off-air note. For more interviews, fun and audio and video, please visit the homepage at www.radiofirsttremor.com.vizinvictorinizinnancy and my official podcast network home of www.daverabbit.podomatic.com. Until next time, this is Dave Rabbit. Peace, my brothers and sisters. Peace.